This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The multi-resident complex recycling ordinance is going into effect in Normal in just a few days.
The cost of recycling per tenant is going to be pretty low. I can't imagine that the rents will go up.
GLT's Ryan Denham checks into whether Mayor Chris Goose of Normal is right. It's harder to tell than you might think. Plus, the governor of Puerto Rico has resigned after massive protests. ISU's head of Latin American studies unpacks that movement. And Laura Kennedy brings us Grand Opera on the Prairie. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. After years of lobbying and waiting, Illinois State University students will finally have access to recycling at their off-campus apartments starting next month. Turns out the timing is still not great. WGLT's Ryan Denham has the story.
The Town of Normal's multifamily recycling ordinance goes into effect August 1st, requiring landlords to offer recycling or face a $100 per day penalty. But this is happening amid major fluctuations in the global recycling commodity business, which are compressing domestic markets and making it more expensive to recycle. Those fluctuations include China not accepting U.S. recyclables. That's indirectly making implementation of Normal's new recycling ordinance more challenging. That's according to Michael Brown, executive director of the Ecology Action Center in Normal.
Some of it is unfortunately bad timing, but I do think that the system will recover. Recycling will recover. It's gone through more difficult times than this. It's more difficult prices, and so this will bounce out in the end.
Here's how those global pressures on the recycling market trickle down to Normal. Let's use some make-believe numbers here. Let's say it costs a hauler $10 in equipment and labor to pick up and transport your apartment building's recycling. Before, that hauler could charge you $5 and make up the other $5, plus a little profit, by selling the recyclable commodities. But if no one wants to buy those recyclables, the value of them is less than $5, or even zero, and your cost as a landlord goes up as a result. If that hauler has to take some of your stuff to a landfill instead, that costs extra too. Young America is the largest apartment management company in Normal. It looked at several options before deciding to hire its existing garbage hauler to handle its recycling as well. General Manager Andy Netzer says they're ready for August 1st.
So the swing is huge. They are uncomfortable hard bidding it, so we have some trigger events in our contract to adjust for those market conditions. So we're unclear and uncertain about what the future holds for pricing.
The Peoria-based hauler PDC Area Disposal has imposed an additional fee on a sliding scale because of all-time lows in recycling markets. Here's PDC Area Vice President Matt Coulter.
That's not in place with what we've done in the McLean County market yet. But in some of our markets, we do that just to protect ourselves because, again, it's a very volatile commodity, unfortunately, right now.
That makes it hard to project whether the recycling program will lead to higher rents in Normal. Mayor Chris Coos says it shouldn't be that much.
The cost of recycling per tenant is going to be pretty low. I can't imagine that the rents will go up.
The ordinance impacts all multifamily housing units in Normal, not just student apartments. Michael Braun with the Ecology Action Center says he's still hearing concerns about the cost of doing this.
There was one rental company that I talked to the other day that was very much on a fixed budget. It was essentially public housing, and so they were concerned about how they would be able to fit this into their budget.
Andy Netzer says Young America is trying to pass through the cost to tenants in some cases. On a few properties, he says the cost is being included in a tenant's utility allowance, helping property owners recover some of the cost.
We're doing what we can. The market will bear out the rents, and just like if any expense increases dramatically, it doesn't always change the look and the feel and the living experience for a resident.
Yes, it's an added service, but Netzer says it's still unclear how much student tenants will value the recycling option. Elizabeth Reed says that value is high. She's the new program director at ISU's Office of Sustainability. She says most ISU students grew up in communities where recycling was ubiquitous.
Before this, taking on this role, I taught at ISU for 11 years, and all the time in my classes I heard, what can we do about getting recycling in the apartments? What can we do about getting recycling? So this is definitely something that they want. Really, it's antiquated that we didn't have it before, and so it is time that we have it.
Other than price volatility, the biggest challenge as August 1st nears will be education. How do you tell 14,000 off-campus ISU students what they can and can't recycle? Matt Coulter with PDC Area says one in four items that gets thrown into a recycling bin is contaminated and can't be recycled and will be taken to a landfill regardless.
You know, putting styrofoam into a container, you know, that says no styrofoam, but they throw styrofoam from the box because they don't want to take the time to get the styrofoam out of the box. So, you know, that is an example of kind of the dilemma our whole industry is in.
Elizabeth Reed says ISU's Office of Sustainability will task a group of interns to serve as recycling ambassadors this coming fall.
Going to some of the different apartment complexes, going to some of the sorority and fraternity houses and being in on, you know, their chapter meetings and that type of thing, and really encouraging everyone just to be aware of what they're consuming and where it should go.
Michael Braun with the Ecology Action Center says they're offering recycling toolkits to landlords and can provide educational materials upon request, like customized flyers and posters.
We want to encourage the rental companies, if they do have any, you know, questions, any need for assistance, some consultation, or educational resources, to reach out to us.
Property owners have until August 1st to begin offering recycling. Coulter says finding space has been a hurdle, and many apartment owners have added 95-gallon recycling containers. A few have done larger 2 or 4 yard containers. The town of Normal is not initially requiring recycling containers to be visually walled off or screened, as is required for waste containers. That could happen, though, after 2022. Here's Normal Inspections Director Greg Tremmel.
We gave them essentially a 3-year pass on screening these. You know, our hope is that as it becomes a little more norm and the tenant base gets used to, okay, we have recycling containers now, the idea is, or hope is, that, you know, maybe the waste receptacle can become a little smaller, and then, you know, the recycling container can kind of fit in that same enclosure. We won't know until, you know, we see how it goes.
The town of Normal will have a relatively light touch on overall enforcement of the new ordinance. There won't be recycling cops hitting the street August 1st to write those $100-a-day fines. Instead, Tremmel says compliance will be rolled into the annual apartment inspection program. But there'll also be complaint-based responses.
Or if someone were to call and say, hey, you know, we moved back in and, you know, my friend lives in a such-and-such building and they've got containers and we don't, then we would respond in that regard.
Apartment owners have had plenty of time to adjust. The Normal Town Council approved the ordinance back in July of 2018, though it didn't go into full effect until August 1st. Here's Mayor Coos.
And the way that is structured is we really want to be able to work with the multifamily property owners to make sure this works for everybody.
It'll take several months to measure the ordinance's success. Landlords have been adding recycling containers for the past several months, but most students are not back in town yet. Move-in week is also not a true representation of recycling use because there's an unusual amount of volume. Over the long term, the ordinance should help increase the community-wide recycling rate, which is around 42% at last check. That's the percentage of total municipal solid waste generated that is recycled instead of landfilled. The ordinance will also require haulers to file an annual report with Michael Braun at the Ecology Action Center, which tracks the recycling rate.
We do, of course, anticipate that this should help bump things up.
That's Ryan Denham speaking with the Ecology Action Center's Michael Braun and others about the multifamily recycling ordinance. ISU's move-in starts the week of August 12th. The first day of classes is August 19th.
Support for GLT comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting's Community Service Grant and from a grant from the Illinois Arts Council Agency. These grants help fund Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and other programming on which you depend for news, information, and entertainment. Additional support comes from GLT contributing listeners. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, Grand Opera on the Prairie with Laura Kennedy. The governor of Puerto Rico, Ricardo Rosello, resigned this week after a storm of protest coalesced in 12 days of demonstrations against corruption, lack of government performance, and so on. It was touched off by the publication of hundreds of pages of chat room transcripts among the governor and his friends. Here to talk about that and the future of Puerto Rico are Mora Toro Morn, the head of Latin American and Latino Studies at Illinois State University and a proud Puerto Ricano herself, and independent scholar Professor Dainali Rodriguez. In Central and Southern America, there is the political tradition of the caudillo, the big man, the one in charge who everyone looks for political solutions and leadership. Professor Rodriguez, has Puerto Rico been part of that tradition, and how does it relate to what happened there this week?
There is definitely a tradition of strong men in power. Politics in Puerto Rico are usually characterized by the idea that one man would lead the change. And that is very common across Latin America and Central America. Yet there is also...
And sometimes small-town America, to be fair.
Yeah, that's true. But there is also a certain understanding or belief that because we are associated with the United States, things would not get to the worst outcome, that there is always this idea that the U.S. would intervene to avoid any type of excess of or abuse of power.
What was the effect of that idea on Puerto Rican politics?
Our politics are characterized by a very strong party system. What the party says is what the party goes, is where the party goes and where the people go. People follow the lead of one leader, which is usually the president of the party. Rarely are any independent candidates because the structure doesn't allow for that.
Right. And in many ways, it's very similar to the United States system because it's sort of bipartisan, right? You have the pro-statehood party, and then you have the Commonwealth Party. And so the governor represents the pro-statehood party. And then the Commonwealth Party, which, by the way, today is a celebration of the 60-plus years of the development of Puerto Rico's Constitution, which actually birthed this, you know, kind of Commonwealth. And interestingly enough, the Commonwealth Party was led by this very important figure in Puerto Rican history, which you might actually place in the history of caudillos, which is Luis Muñoz Marín. Right, Luis Muñoz Marín is the father of the Commonwealth, is the father of the development model, and so it's attributed with these kinds of qualities of a caudillo. Caudillo defined as a very charismatic, very powerful, and sort of historic figure. There are other elements of caudillismo that do not necessarily apply to Puerto Rico, and that I think that's where Dainali is trying to kind of distinguish the caudillismo. But I do want to say something connected to your question about the caudillismo and Latin America, and that is that the protests that you have seen for the last 12 days in Puerto Rico place Puerto Rico squarely within the tradition of massive national and social movements in Latin America. So it's very easy for a lot of people to think of Puerto Rico as being part of the United States and consequently influenced by U.S. politics, influenced by ways of doing things. Yet what we have seen in Puerto Rico in the last 12 days is really a retreat to the South, if you will, right? A retreat in terms of mass protest demonstrations, peaceful across a wide cross-section of Puerto Rican social classes.
What distinguished these manifestations from previous ones is precisely the absence, the strong absence of political figures leading these mm-hmm. expressions. These were people organizing themselves mm-hmm. in the face of the absence of a government that functions the way it should for the people.
This is the first time in territory status that a governor has resigned. That's more than 60 years, right?
Or, that is correct, yeah.
How big is that?
There are many things to take into account. This was a movement that came out very creatively in many, many ways. It was consistent. It was a movement that empowered the people for the first time. And I think that the most important work comes now. It's happening as we speak. Mm-hmm. But it's important to realize that this is a gesture of agency mm-hmm. among people that have always been removed of agency.
Mora Tora Morn, often in the wake of a government falling because of a protest movement, Egypt, for instance, the entrenched elites drop back, regroup, and take over again in a different form, a different face. Is that likely to happen in Puerto Rico?
Well, it remains to be seen. I think it remains to be seen. If we place too much focus on the resignation of the governor, I think that we're missing really the larger significance of what happened in Puerto Rico, because it is indeed about, it's an awakening moment. It means that when you look at the cross-section of the individuals that were involved in the mass protests of the last 12 days, you find a lot of young people, you find a lot of working-class people, you find a lot of educated Puerto Ricans. And so what you find is a cross-section of Puerto Ricans from across social classes that are saying enough is enough. They made the governor sort of the central focus of their first demand. But I think that one of the things that is happening in Puerto Rico right now is precisely that. It is precisely how will the current establishment begin to meet the demands of this emerging movement, and how will they line themselves? Because it is evident that corruption actually goes both ways in terms of both political parties, and there are very few political leaders in Puerto Rico today that can actually kind of raise their hand and say, I am above all of this and I can lead, including the person that is actually supposed to follow in his footsteps, that herself is actually mere with all kinds of assertions about corruption and failure to respond to the needs of Puerto Rican people. So will the political elites, in an answer to your question, will the political elites sort of reassemble themselves? Perhaps, but I think that what I would like to see, and what I think is evident in the protests, is that out of these protests, new political leaders will come and will come to the surface to demand the kind of social change and the kinds of political decisions that are serving the people of Puerto Rico.
Danny Lee, how can the interest groups that Mora just laid out, the educated, the young elites, or the young and the other ones that she talked about, how can they maintain their network, their connections going forward?
I would like to first of all add to Maura's answer that there is an awareness about how social elites are playing the political book. The major mall, and probably the unique mall of Plaza Las Americas, which is the biggest shopping venue, had to close for 2 days precisely because of the manifestations. At the same time, you see in social media posts people asking for the manifestants, for the people to go spend their money in Old San Juan, mm-hmm. where all the merchants were affected by all the protests and the manifestations. So there is an awareness of how money plays into politics. And we have to add to that the chat that revealed all of these underground dealings of the governor or the ex-governor with their close associates revealed that play of power and those connections. So people are very aware of that. Mm-hmm. To answer to your question, basically, people are being connected in very contemporary ways. Social media has played a big part. I've seen colleagues mentioning that this is the summer Puerto Rican spring, in reference to the Arab Spring. So social media has played a part. People are organizing themselves in ways that are new and that share similarities with other social movements across the globe. And I think that there is an intention to keep those manifestations and those connections happening. Right now, they haven't canceled all the manifestations that they had planned, but they are giving them a new twist. Okay, so what's next? So they're already organizing to try to make this something that is not one day, but something consistent, a consistent effort.
Mm-hmm. Let's ask the glass half full, half empty question. I mean, it took so much to unseat this governor. I mean, ineffectiveness in the wake of the hurricane, corruption up and down the scale, arrogance among the ruling party that caused some people to move away from him, and a concentration of power in his young clique of politicians that isolated itself. So just bad politics, but stupid politics. And then the arrogance displayed in this release of social media chat room stuff that displayed the disdain with which he and his circle held much of the populace. That takes a lot to unseat a governor. Is that something that should be depressing or uplifting? Uplifting that he's gone, or depressing that it took all that?
I choose to see the glass half full. It took us 12 days, and it has never happened before. And people were able to organize themselves. And we live currently in the United States. We live Twitter by Twitter, post by post, from the president and their associates. And we have seen similar accusations in the national sphere. Puerto Rico, the territory, the U.S. colonial territory, was able to unseat a governor in 12 days. And that was with 3.8 million people. How can we serve as an example to others? How can we serve as an example to national politics? Mm-hmm. An example of union and joining, because politics is... it's a game easily played when you play divisional politics. However, we found the strength to find the similarities among ourselves and the concerns that we have, and share our concerns and do something about it. What is it for the United States, our nation, to do the same? What do they need?
Will the U.S. pay attention to this example?
That is...
I hope so. I sure hope so. And I really think that there's a group of people that I think we're placing a lot of our analysis in terms of the movement of the masses and the social movements that actually have made it possible. But let's not forget that the reason why we're talking about this Ricky Gate and the leaky and the Ricky leaks and all of that is because of the work of journalists. It was actually a center for Puerto Rican journalists that actually made it public and exposed it. So I think that having freedom of the press and the work that journalists are doing, both in Puerto Rico and in the United States, is very important, because they are revealing to the people, they are actually recording and documenting to the people exactly what is happening. The 800 pages of misogyny, homophobia, I think your average Puerto Rican knew that went on. I think seeing it in writing and seeing the disrespect and seeing how women, female leaders in the island were targeted That's really what lit this match and what I think would serve as a very important lesson for groups that organize. And I think I probably want to go back to a question that you raised a few minutes ago, because this is really the work of civic groups. I think we see the masses, and I think the masses are to be admired and I think to be respected, and much credit needs to be placed upon the power of the people. But underlying the power of the people is actually the civic sector of Puerto Rican society. They're the heroes of everyday organizing that they have taken, that has taken place in the aftermath of Hurricane Irma and Maria. And they have constructed, in the absence of the state, they have constructed civic society around all of these small groups, like it's the Colectivo Feminista, working class groups, youth groups. And so there is a civic society in American society that is, has been organizing day in and day out. And I think the time will come for those in the United States to really show the power in terms of mass expression and the kind of social movements that we have seen in Puerto Rico.
Will this misogyny displayed in the release of chat room documents have a lasting effect on the traditionally patriarchal political scene in Puerto Rico, and in fact in a lot of countries? It's not just Puerto Rico that's patriarchal in its politics. Will there be a lasting effect in uplifting the role of women in politics?
Well, women are at the forefront of this movement, mm-hmm. and not because of what is being said, mm-hmm. but actually what men are doing to women in Puerto Rico. We are facing a really serious problem with domestic violence. When you look at the statistics in terms of the number of women that die in the hands of their husbands and their lovers, it is really remarkable. The violence that women are encountering in the hands of their husbands, their partners, their friends, and the hands of the state. And so I think that it was written and that it was evident in the chats is really the last drop that spilled this glass, and that have actually sent, when you look at the faces of the people that are in the protest, a lot of them are women, a lot of them are young women that are saying, we've had enough with this. We want to create a new Puerto Rico where women are respected, and where even those that are also in other borders of Puerto Rican society, like the LGBTQ community, are also respected. And so this is really a transformative movement in Puerto Rican society. And I think it is a movement that can spill onto the streets of Chicago and the streets of the United States, because the actors are there.
This was a governor who was pro-statehood, as you mentioned. What will this do to the drive towards statehood?
I think that for the first time, people were able to think beyond the colonial status. I mean, there is a claim, and don't get me wrong, there is a claim to cancel the junta imposed by the United States. But I don't think that the statehood movement is strong right now, not in the island or in the United States. The same way, we can say the same about the independent movement. I think that perhaps the distinguishing trait in this movement was precisely that people for the first time were able to go beyond those labels. And I say this because political parties are organized under these labels. That is the main force that move group of people to vote in the island. However, they were not present in this manifestation.
Do you think it will realign politics toward more of the basic functions of government and providing security and economic opportunity and economic growth and services?
I can only hope. There are still a big group of movements looking to lead us back into, let's think about the colonial status. Let's think about what is our future. But I think that we need to go back precisely to the basic functions of what a government is and how a government functions before trying to answer any of those questions.
This is an observation that actually must be credited to Dinah Lee, because she is really the first one who made it. And I think it needs to be said here. When you look at the massive wave of people and all of the flags that are in all of the pictures, and I encourage you to look at all of the pictures that came out of the protest, you do not see a single party flag among the people that were demonstrating, which I think really speaks to the point that she's making, and I think that it's implicit in your question, which is to look at these protests and these demonstrations through the traditional political lens. It really misses the way in which this protest was disruptive of that political lens and was really demanding broader changes in Puerto Rican society, and was demanding that the state and the government of Puerto Rico fulfills its major role, which is to protect and serve the people of Puerto Rico. In the aftermath of Maria, the absence of the state in providing some of the most basic needs for the Puerto Rican people, including the burial of its people, for me represents such an affront to the Puerto Rican people, and such in Spanish, has much more sort of strength, falta de respeto, that not even the dead were respected. And so I think that that really has pushed that political lens to the side. And I think people are demanding respect, end of corruption, and serious changes, which include, I think, as Dinah Lee has correctly referenced, the canceling of the debt, right? And also the serious reassessment of the current committee that is ruling out of Puerto Rico, that is actually promoting all of these policies that are really causing widespread vulnerabilities in Puerto Rico, that are causing widespread changes in Puerto Rican families and their ability to provide for themselves. And I think as a scholar of migration, that are also responsible for the movement of Puerto Ricans from the island to the United States, because ultimately that's one of the ways in which Puerto Ricans cope with these massive problems in Puerto Rico, is to come to the United States, to come to Central Illinois, to come to, you know, the South, to go to Alaska, to go to all of the places where they can actually find the ability to provide for their families.
Maura Toro Morn is the head of Latin American and Latino Studies at Illinois State University and a proud Puerto Ricano, as is Professor Dinah Rodriguez, an independent scholar.
Why public radio? We turn to WGLT contributors for answers.
Hi, I'm Jenny Keir.
There are a lot of answers, but also some common threads. It's fact-based, it's an avenue for lifelong learning, and it's local.
I feel like the news that I get on GLT is generally really, really fair and balanced, which is something that I really value.
What's your answer to Why Public Radio, and will you financially support WGLT?
Please join me with your pledge now. Go online to WGLT.org.
Support for WGLT comes from the Illinois Shakespeare Festival, featuring Caesar through August 10th. Enjoy a modern take on Shakespeare's classic tragedy and stay cool indoors at the ISU Center for the Performing Arts Theater. Details and tickets at IllinoisShakes.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, enrollment challenges for some of Illinois' public universities, not ISU as it turns out. We'll delve into one of those other regionals. Bloomington Normal's Opera Company has a 1-2 punch of excitement with their 2019 season, featuring two standards of opera repertoire, a sweetly tragic romance along with a hedonistic farce. WGLT Arts correspondent Laura Kennedy has more.
Emerging artists take center stage in a pair of timeless classics, giants of the opera world, this summer at Mio Opera. Running August 1st and 3rd, it's the opera that proves revenge is best served with champagne, Strauss's Die Fledermaus. And August 2nd and 4th, it's Puccini's passion-filled La Bohème. Produced and directed by Mio Opera's John and Tracy Cook, The pair are especially excited to bring La Boheme to the stage, as it has special meaning for both of them.
Well, La Boheme is an opera I did a lot when I was professionally singing.
And it was my first gig, too.
It was her first gig. It was actually one of my first biggest gigs. I did Marcello in the Montreal Opera, which I just really loved. And then I've done it several times since.
Marcello's the friend of the main character.
The painter, the awful painter, yeah.
And his paintings are pretty awful in this production, so you'll enjoy the artwork.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, you won't.
No, you won't.
So, you know, I've sung it a lot, and we talked about it, and she'd done it, and it's like, come, let's do La Boheme. It's challenging because it's got some difficult roles. You know, Mimi Musetta and Rodolfo, they're all difficult roles to sing. I thought, you know, we can do this. We can make it work. And
it's a great standard piece.
It is.
Most students don't get the opportunity to perform this opera because it is so intense and difficult. There's a lot of dramatic contrast. You just have to be a really seasoned artist to do the show. So this is an opportunity for people who are ready to do this music, to do this repertoire in a professional venue.
Right. And we're doing it in Italian with English supertitles, so people won't feel lost.
And they'll get the nuances of the actual language of the opera. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So have you played Mimi before, Tracy?
Yes, I have.
Tell me about the role.
She's actually very feisty. I think a lot of people play her as this downplayed, because Musetta is such a big character, because all the characters are all contrasts. Mimi, her music is more demure and more pure, whereas Musetta is more fiery and sexy. So Mimi is basically looking for love at the end of her life. She actually is very ill, and she meets someone, and she opens her heart to them and allows them to come in and experiences love, and then, as in all opera, she dies. Mm-hmm. And then the opera's over, and we all start crying, and it's really sad. But what it's about is, it's the what if. What if I go down to my neighbor's house, this is basically the story, knock on his door, and see if he'll let me light my candle. And if he does that, will he actually light inside of me love and passion? And that's what happens. They fall in love. And so it's really about what if you take that chance on love in your life and valuing those who you love. It's universal.
The opera is universal.
The themes are all universal.
And I'm trying to get across to the singers and the actors that we are recreating reality on the stage. We're not just like acting like we're sick. We're not acting like we're not sad because we're putting it on, but we're trying to feel this stuff. And the music gives so much of the story part of it.
The action and the motion of the story is in the music for Puccini. That's the style, the Verismo period. And then the Verismo period is a period in opera of realism. So instead of just like a fluffy opera, people park and park, this is where people are actually like pouring themselves out on stage, their emotions, their feelings, real life people. Whereas before, the characters may be based on fairy tales or myths or other kinds of grand opera showings. Now it's about real people, everyday people, of people in the seats. And the opera was so popular and is so popular that they did turn it into a musical, the musical as we all love and know as Rent. So the exact same story. So if you really enjoy Rent, you're going to adore La Boheme because it's the same story, just told in a different way. Well, I'm doing it in the 1830s. But even though it's that long ago, the period, we still identify with the feelings and actions of our characters. For example, Marcello, I've made him an alcoholic. And that's why he has such a tumultuous relationship with Musetta. And in the end, I think they both, after Mimi passes, they both feel like they can move on with their lives and they can value what they have.
It was told to me years ago by someone that this would be a really good first opera for someone who's never been to the opera before. What do you guys think of that?
Think definitely.
So. Boheme's got the realism of life and pain and death and dying and sickness, but it also has some lighter scenes in it that can be absolutely hysterical. So it's
are hysterical since I'm directing
okay.
it, so
well,
it is funny.
It will
funny.
Be hysterical will be when she's
yes,
stages
yes,
them.
Yes, yes,
but it's a good balance.
And I also think that the story is something that's easy to understand. Mm-hmm. It's not. So a lot of people say, "Oh, opera is so complex. I don't understand. They're parking and barking in this foreign language, and I don't." No, the Puccini is so he writes the opera so perfectly that every note represents the emotions and feelings that you understand it through the music. So you're not going to be confused. You're actually going to follow along with them in the story. Because there's nothing worse than coming to a show and not knowing what's going on. But because Puccini did such a great job on this work, everybody can understand it.
Well, in addition to La Boheme, you're also doing Deflator Mouse, which is kind of on the opposite end of the spectrum.
Totally.
Now, is it technically an operetta? And if so, what makes an operetta different from an opera?
The opera is completely sung. Whereas in operetta, it's like a musical. You're gonna have breaks of dialogue to move the story along, and then you're gonna have ensembles and arias and duets to then talk about that situation. So it's just music and dialogue together, whereas opera is just all the story is fully sung.
This is a Viennese operetta, so it's quite the confection, and the plot is sort of farcical. Deflator Mouse, by the way, we should say that translates to the bat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what it's all about is the bat is basically two friends went to a costume party that belong to high society, and they both got very drunk, and one basically couldn't make it home. So we left him in the park with his bat costume on, and then people came and laughed at him. Well, because back then, making a fool of yourself, it gets into the papers and everything. So everybody in town knew about what it was. So the friend is like, so Dr. Falco, who is a friend, and then Eisenstein is the friend who played the joke originally on Dr. Falco. He's like, I'm gonna get him back. So this opera is about Dr. Falco getting him back for making him the bat in the park. Mm-hmm.
What are the vocal challenges in this operetta? And are we singing in English, or do we have the singing in German?
Normally the show is done in the language of the venue. So like most people do it in English, but it was originally written in German. I wouldn't say that the roles are vocally demanding. I think that like Bowen, they're very similar like demands vocally for voice, but it's being a singer and then having to speak. And I think that a lot of singers are used to getting up there and singing, but then when they're asked to do a play or dialogue, that's hard. So the hardest thing actually is doing the dialogue and memorizing it, because most singers are accustomed to using the music to memorize and to express the show.
And well, you're directing. Written a new dialogue.
Yes, for the Deflator Mouse, I have actually rewrote all the dialogue so that it tells the story, but in a new and different way.
So yeah, you are directing. So how are you helping, other than rewriting and helping them that way? How are you helping your performers?
Well, we're doing the show not only from an operatic side, focusing on the music and using it to tell a drama, but then playing on the words and the dialogue to tell the drama as well, and the physicalities that go with it. So it's more about basically working like not only an opera singer, but as an actor together, and making them both seamless. So the acting and the singing combine to make a beautiful combination.
So that is a pretty good challenge. What do the young talents who work with Mio Opera get out of this experience?
They get a full role to put on their resume. So then roles, because some people are singing multiple roles. They get the experience of being on stage and singing with an orchestra. Right now in the opera world, there's not that many opportunities for the younger generations and also established artists to necessarily bump up to the next level, because funding for opera and the arts in general is declining, and it's very sad. So this is a way for us to provide those opportunities for the artists to do those roles, and also for Bloomington Normal to experience the genre that's not normally done here. We are the only opera company between St. Louis and Chicago that is fully functioning and providing this genre. So not only is the community benefiting from our opera program, but the young artists as well.
That was Tracy and John Cook from Mio Opera. The productions of Deflator Mouse and La Boheme run August 1st through the 4th in the Illinois State University Center for Performing Arts. I'm Laura Kennedy.
You can hear John and Tracy Cook talk about taking a cue from La Boheme and living the bohemian lifestyle in bonus audio on our website, wglt.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Western Illinois is not alone in colleges that have experienced recent drops in student enrollment, but the decrease has been especially acute at Western, where last fall's enrollment dropped 10% compared to the previous year. IPR's Rich Egger talked to one of the people now in charge of turning around Western's numbers.
That person is Doug Freed. He's the university's new director of undergraduate admissions and enrollment services. Freed says he spent his career working in admissions, enrollment, and enrollment marketing at universities and community colleges. He considers the job at Western a professional challenge and a great opportunity.
I think that there are a lot of good academic programs here at Western. I think there's a lot of opportunity. And I sensed in my interview that there was a lot of people who wanted help. They wanted some guidance. They wanted to be able to do some things a little differently than they had done in the past. From a professional standpoint, that is really attractive to me, to be able to have the opportunity to do some things differently in that admissions enrollment area and bring in my experiences from the past.
So you've been in town for about a month, and you're already talking about doing some things differently. Well, what sort of things are you already looking at?
One of the things that we're doing is we're looking at our communication plans and our communication flows. We are looking at making sure that we are aligned with texting, email, personal contact, on-campus visits, and things of that nature, where we're really being intentional about our communication and getting students to campus. We are implementing a new piece of software called a CRM, or a customer relationship management software, this summer, and that will enable us to communicate better with students more frequently, and then to be able to track those communications. That's certainly going to be a help. We did a mini campaign a couple weeks ago combining all those elements, and we in 1 week had a 250% increase in applications compared to the same week last year. And so again, aligning those things where we're not just doing an email here and then a text later, but trying to get all those things aligned, I think is something that we're really looking at.
Have you found there is a recruitment challenge that is particular to Western Illinois University?
Again, I've only been here a month. The little bit of data I've seen, cost is certainly a concern for all students, and we are looking at that as much as we can. It's on the minds of a lot of students. We do get a lot of first-generation students here at Western, and low-income students, Pell-eligible students, as do a lot of universities in Illinois. So that's a concern, I think, on a statewide basis, is the affordability of college. And we are making every effort we can to make college as affordable as possible. Our Western Commitment Scholarship has certainly helped with that. The AIM High Scholarship from the state helps, and other things that we're doing. But we have over half of our freshman class this fall is coming in on the Western Commitment Scholarship. So that's certainly been effective in helping reduce some of those costs for students.
How large is the projected freshman class?
Things are changing daily, and we are projecting we are looking at level new student enrollment across everything, across freshman, transfer, graduate. It's probably too early to actually predict a final class. We are certainly looking at, if it's a decrease, a much smaller decrease than we've had in the past, and a much smaller decrease than I think was originally thought, once the numbers all shake out.
Do you want students to come to the Macomb or Quad Cities campuses rather than taking courses online? Is there something you feel students gain from actually attending a physical location?
There's certainly differences in terms of online or in-person education. In terms of our thoughts from enrollment, we want to meet students where they are. So if online works for students, then we want the students to take classes online. If they want to come to campus and have the campus experience here, live on campus, that's great too. If they want to commute to this campus or commute in the Quad Cities, or there are even some residential facilities near the Quad Cities that aren't university owned, we're fine with that too. We want to again meet the students where they are and provide the services and the supports and the education that would help them wherever they are in their life. So some students may not be able to pack up and move from 2 hours away to come here to campus, but that's fine. Then we can help and support you with online classes.
Is there a program or an idea, something from a past job that you would like to bring here that you think might work at Western?
Yeah, one of the things we're looking at is students who have stopped out of Western Illinois or who are adults who have some college. One of the things we want to look at are some type of perhaps a debt forgiveness program or ideas of how to get those students back in and removing the barriers that might be in place for them, whether it be academic, financial, personal. Again, for some of those students, they may not realize some of the online options we have now for completing degrees. And so that's something I certainly want to look at. Another thing, again, is also what we've already done, and that's integrating the media so that we are being very intentional about our communication and making sure that we are across media having the same message and having enough messaging power to kind of break through some of the clutter. I mean, there's a lot, every college is communicating with students. We want to make sure that they think of Western and are aware of Western's opportunities.
Doug Freed is the new Director of Undergraduate Admissions and Enrollment Services at Western Illinois University. He previously served as Director of the Transfer Student Success Center at Wayne State University in Detroit. Freed says Western is offering train tickets for students who would like to attend an orientation program in Macomb on August 1st. Rich Egger reporting.
Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Ryan Denham and Laura Kennedy. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Comment on our Facebook page, we're WGLT-FM, or follow us on Twitter, we're all at WGLT News. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.